You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 24th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
Germany heads to the polls. The UK's government blames Brexit shortages on COVID-19. And do we really need prequels? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, which means it's our in-house daily panel. And this week, the big coloured wheel stopped on the names of Alexa Self and Chris Chermak. They'll be discussing all the day's big stories, and we'll hear from day two of Monocle's Quality of Life conference in Athens. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Monocle 24 producer Alexa Self and Chris Chermak, Monocle's news editor. Hello to you both.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello, Andrew.
You can feel free to jump right in there. Just before we start discussing the German election in detail, what preparations are you both making to enjoy the coverage this weekend? Have you got some cans in, inviting a few people around to stay up and watch the votes come in?
I mean, you know, my preparation is to actually go to Berlin this weekend to help cover it for Monocle 24. So okay, I'll be there where the action is, possibly following along Berlin's mayoral election as well.
That is taking it to heart. My point being, it does strike me as odd that people in the United Kingdom who do stay up all night to watch US presidential elections really don't seem all that bothered about German or French elections.
Well, from what I gather from my, you know, not extensive research of the German electoral system.
That's right, manage expectations.
The vote itself isn't particularly exciting, and nor does it ultimately, the decision about who the chancellor will be won't be made on Sunday.
It's more actually, though, that the election also goes very quickly, so we already know in Germany by like 7, 8pm or so what the actual results are. So much so that the most fascinating part I always find of the elections is that they have a debate of the candidates still on the night to then talk about, you know, the one who won and the one who lost. They put it to them right there and then, which I always find quite hilarious. Like, how do you feel that you've just lost a massive election? How do you feel that you've won?
Well, will this be the voice proclaiming some sort of tentative triumph this weekend?
Thank you. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, these have been very turbulent times for our EU Council presidency. It has been marked deeply by the COVID-19 pandemic, both in terms of content and technology.
That was Vice Chancellor Olaf Scholz of the Social Democratic Party, who better be hoping he wins, because I'm not sure there's much future in after-dinner speaking awaiting him. Germany does vote on Sunday in a federal election, which will decide, among other things, who will succeed Angela Merkel as Chancellor. Polls suggest that almost anything is possible. Merkel's Christian Democratic Union is running neck and neck with the Social Democrats on around 25% of the vote each, ahead of the Greens on 16%, the Free Democratic Party on circa 12%, and the seething far-right yahoos of Alternative for Germany just in double figures. A coalition government seems the likely outcome, perhaps of more than two parties. But who will be in it? Chris, let's start with the big question first. At this distance, who does seem like the likeliest next Chancellor of Germany? It is an important job.
It is an important job, and it is very hard to say. It is fair to say at this point, because it's gotten so close. But if I had to put money on it, I would still say that this is Olaf Scholz's race to lose at this point, which in itself is quite fascinating, given the fact that just about a month ago, it looked like the Social Democrats would have their worst outcome potentially in history, even worse than the last time, which was their worst outcome in history. They have now sort of picked up again from that, and it's the Christian Democrats that are most likely to have their worst outcome in history, even if they do somehow manage to get just about into first place in this race.
Alexis, as we have heard, Olaf Scholz, if indeed it is to be him, is not one of your barnstorming firebrands, as politicians go. There's something in the current context of the grand scheme of things that's quite reassuring about watching German politics, though, I find. Just a lot of quite earnest, competent, dull people quietly getting on with it.
Yeah, well, as I was saying at the beginning, from what I understand of the German system, it's built to ensure consensus between the parties. You know, the coalition government is, you know, you can almost, that's the one thing we can predict about what will happen on Sunday, is that there will be a coalition government. You know, who will be the chancellor, we don't yet know. I mean, the German electorate vote for the parties, and then the Bundestag appoints the chancellor, again, you know, to ensure this consensus. And actually, as is the case often in multi-system, multi-party systems, the biggest divides are kind of almost, or the most, the biggest kind of clashes happen often internally within the party, because, you know, rival leaders aren't looking to kind of upset other parties too much. Scholz, I don't know. I have to admit, I didn't know much about him before this particular election campaign, but, you know, and he's nicknamed Scholzomat by the German public for his robotic speeches. I'm not
exactly
casting
right.
any aspersions based on what we just heard. But yeah, I think that is, you know, and especially compared to Armin Laschet and Annalena Baerbock, his kind of even temperament, you know, after 16 years of Merkel, obviously would be appealing and would look like the continuity candidate, even if he is from a different party.
Chris, when this campaign got underway, there was an amount of ballyhoo at the start about the possibility of a significant vote for the Greens, who were polling at 28% in April. They have now shipped a lot of votes to the point where they are down at around 16%. What do you think's gone on there? Is that just the novelty wearing off, or is it people, as the actual day of the vote grows nearer, thinking maybe we should just stick with what we know?
I think it is a little bit of the latter in particular. There were some missteps by the Greens and their candidate, Annalena Baerbock. She kind of showed through this campaign a little bit. Certain there were some questions about possible plagiarism, using certain speeches, some things that kind of took the wind out of her sails. And I think what was interesting, though, was this campaign kind of shifted, you feel, in Germany from being about the policies and the Greens sort of being ahead because they had sort of the policies on their side, particularly climate change and the issues on their side. It kind of shifted from that to more of a personality thing. And in that sense, you feel like it was even the Germans a little bit having this thought of like, well, we no longer have Angela Merkel. We want somebody who is reliable, who has experience, who is a stable force at the top of the ticket. And I think Annalena Baerbock and the Greens perhaps also just reached a little bit too far by saying, we are now ready to be the number one party. We are going to put forward a chancellor candidate. That in itself is actually a weird formality. Not every party in Germany puts forward a chancellor candidate. This was the first time the Greens had done so. And I think there were some voters who may have just sort of looked at that as well and kind of said, well, hang on, actually, no, not yet. Like, you were on 10% 4 years ago. Let's pull you back a little bit. They're still going to improve quite dramatically on their last result. But I think a lot of voters in that sense have gone back to the old stable. And that is also, interestingly, though, why you could make an argument for also why Olaf Scholz, right at the end, perhaps might not make it across the line, because you also have a number of Christian Democratic voters who maybe, you know, were annoyed, angry with Armin Laschet. He hasn't been particularly inspiring as a candidate. But right at the end, they're kind of like, well, but I've been voting for the CDU for so long. Do I really want to go to somebody else, even if it's Olaf Scholz? Maybe I should just vote for the party that I am comfortable with at the end of the day.
Alexis, final quick thought on the German election, and we will be talking about it, obviously, all next week once the results become clear. But it is the first time the Greens have put up a chancellor candidate. But if they end up in government, it wouldn't be the first time they've done that. They were part of a coalition with the Social Democrats before Merkel was chancellor. But in the current context, with, I think, thoughts and feelings and understanding of the climate crisis having advanced a lot more since the early 2000s, would it be a massive big deal for the whole developed democratic world if the Green Party was in government in a country as important as Germany?
Definitely, definitely. And a country with such a large manufacturing sector as Germany has. And I think, again, because of the way the system exists, that you can have, you know, in the US and the UK, the two big main parties have to encompass, you know, every kind of they have to be a broad church. So, you know, if a significant Green politician is going to arise in the US or the UK, it's probably going to have to come from, you know, within the Democrat or the Labour Party. Mm. So, you know, if the Greens in Germany were the kingmakers, if they were in coalition with the SPD government, I think that that would be a huge signal to the world, and especially ahead of the COP26 summit in November.
Well, let's now look, for as long as we can stand to, at the UK, currently bracing itself for what is already being described as an autumn of discontent. It is becoming harder to avoid noticing that certain items are in supply shorter than we are generally able to take for granted. Today, it is petrol, and while the number of stations actually closing as a consequence is small, queues at the pumps have a way of perpetuating themselves. At the heart of all such difficulties is a colossal shortage of truck drivers. By the estimates of the Road Haulage Association, we are roughly 100,000 below par. Chris, where did they all go?
Where did they all go? I have to say, first of all, that we were just talking about this yesterday. I was trying to avoid this story myself as much as possible. I kind of was tempted
Wear the tartan shirt then?
That's a fair point, the tartan shirt. But I was just, you know, whenever it comes to these stories of discontent and crisis, I tend to try and avoid them till the last minute, where I actually have to pay attention to the news, because everything really is collapsing. It's very easy to sort of speak of a crisis before it's actually a crisis, I find. But this one, yes, is genuinely interesting, particularly because of, yes, where have the truck drivers gone? And also, where have they gone so quickly? How has this all of a sudden hit upon us in the last month that, wait a minute, all of a sudden we don't have enough truck drivers? Like, how does that happen in such a short period of time? It is obviously partly pandemic related. It is partly Brexit related. But what just strikes me of this more than anything else is, how are we not at all prepared, and how does this crisis develop over the space of a month or so? We haven't been able to train new truck drivers. All of this surely was a bit more foreseeable than it has
been. It's almost like we have a government led by somebody who's professional background involved frantically winging it on deadline.
Well, I think actually we were warned about this. And again, you know, to try and place the reasons for there being a shortage of truck drivers in the UK, one might look back to last December, when they were being forced to basically sleep in a car park in Kent because that was in January, was it? After the...
I lose track. It was circa around that time.
It's hard. Winter. It was in the winter, and I doubt it was, you know, used by the Haulier Association to recruit new candidates. Obviously, Brexit has played a part, and, you know, it would be churlish and dishonest of the government to say that it wasn't. I mean, the fact is that it takes, you know, there's something to do with the pay that means that, you know, drivers would be getting paid less if they were working in Europe, and also just the amount of time it takes to process the goods coming from continental Europe into the UK. It means that around 20,000 have left because of Brexit, and then the pandemic added on top of that, and apparently 40,000 tests have been cancelled, Haulier driving tests, which I imagine are pretty technical.
Yeah, well, it is properly hard work, people are now discovering, and the government, Chris, is talking about attempting to step up recruitment and training of HGV drivers. Are you tempted at all?
I don't know if I would say that I was tempted. It is a very tough job. I know the government, for that matter, is also looking at, again, short-term visas and fast-tracking those as well in order to get this moving. But no, I
well,
can't
allowing
say,
some sort of freedom of movement of labour to sort of meet demand where it exists.
Imagine that from the European Union. Yeah, where have we heard that before?
It is a thought.
I would quite like to be a Haulier, actually.
Really?
Need to borrow Chris's plaid shirt, get a trucker hat. I enjoy driving a lot.
I do enjoy driving, yeah. As well. I'll give you that.
And yes. Travelling. And, I mean, you know, it doesn't have the best reputation, the truck driver. Not since Convoy in the 70s. Basically, remake Convoy.
Or is this part of cultural reference, which may be understood by literally nobody listening to any of this but me.
Yeah, well, that's good enough for me. I was reading a study earlier that truck drivers, the profession is incredibly undiverse, and it has doesn't have the best image. The profession is 99% white male, average age of 55. And there's obviously, you know, poor conditions and wages aren't great. So, you know, one possible outcome of this and of the general labour shortage in this country, which, you know, even if you weren't reading the news, you would be able to have noticed, you know, every bar you go into, every restaurant has signs, not every, but, you know, signs saying staff wanted. And, you know, a possible consequence of that is that labour becomes more in demand and therefore wages go up, which is what the government is talking about, hopefully happening to the lorry driving industry, which I think would be a good thing.
Obviously. I mean, I can probably name more than one song by C.W. McCall, which is a rare talent. Chris, the government is urging people not to panic buy. Should we be interpreting that as our cue to go out and panic buy?
I mean, obviously, this just brings me right back to the start of the pandemic, when, of course, there was warnings not to panic buy, and then suddenly we found no toilet paper in any of the shops. So I think people are very inclined to panic buy, yes, as soon as you say that you shouldn't. But having said that, I do feel like we should still wait and see. It's not quite as bad as that. The one thing that worries me, on the other hand, more than even the food, I have to say, is reading this one statistic that shocked me, that gas storage in the UK is so short by design that they only have about 4 to 5 winter days worth of gas in reserve, compared to 16 times that number in Germany, which just shows you how good the Germans are at saving basically everything.
Well, I think also, and again, to go back to what happened in January, I think it was when the Brexit controls came in on goods, was that, you know, in Britain being an island and you know, importing so much of its foodstuffs and obviously its energy as well, you know, the kind of modern supply chains exist on, you know, 2-3 days max in advance. You know, food is coming in and going straight onto the shelves, and as soon as that is disrupted in any, you know, it completely, the whole system kind of collapses, and it shows how kind of, you know, tenuous modern supply chains really are.
Lex, just before the break, because I know we were talking about this earlier, in semi-related news, the opposition Labour Party will begin its annual conference tomorrow in Brighton. It does look set fair to be quite the reenactment of the closing scene from Blazing Saddles, as usual. But Keir Starmer, the leader of the party, has released a lengthy manifesto ahead of the conference. Did it contain any better ideas?
Well, I haven't read each of its 14,000 words, but from what I gather, it was pretty uninspiring, which I think is a word that can be used to describe the man himself. Although, as we were talking about with Olaf Scholz earlier, maybe that's not necessarily such a bad thing. I think, you know, when you're up against Boris Johnson, you either have to go one of two ways. You have to kind of be as charismatic, inverted commas, I want the listeners to know that I was doing that.
He's literally doing the quotes there, listeners.
You know, try and be as kind of, you know, mad and as he is, or, you know, go for the kind of opposite act and be the kind of statesman-like, you know, sober one. The problem is that he's going for that clearly, but there's no substance there, really. He doesn't seem like a great thinker. And, you know, I can't remember. And, you know, I've actually looked at the analysis of his, you know, it's full of these kind of technocratic plaudits and bromides that actually there is no substance to. He's saying, you know, I want to improve social mobility. How? You know, how are you going to do this? That's what I want to know.
That does sound like one of those things, though, Chris, that everybody says. I would actually be quite intrigued at this point by a candidate who just says, I don't want to improve social mobility. Social mobility, the hell with it.
That's very true. But I'm also reminded, for example, of Elizabeth Warren, who was the woman who had a plan for everything and did not do very well as a result. So being a politician isn't always about actually having plans, is it? It's about how charismatic you are and how you present yourself. And that brings back to Germany, Olaf Scholz, stable and calm and reliable, doesn't really have a huge amount of innovative ideas either on the left, and yet somehow he's pulled himself out and into the lead. So it can work.
Chris Chomak and Alexa Self, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you shortly. You are listening to The Daily.
Allianz is proud to partner the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24. For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests, Alexa Self and Chris Chermak. But first, this. Monocle's 2021 Quality of Life Conference in Athens began in earnest today. And to discuss the day's events, we can go now live to Monocle's head of radio, Tom Edwards. He's joined by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, and Europe editor-at-large, Ed Stocker, at Athens' Bernanke Museum.
Yes, thanks very much indeed, Andrew. It is my final check-in of the day today from the Bernanke Museum in Piraeus, bathed in beautiful early evening sunshine, and here to reflect on, I'm going to say, a triumphant return for the Monocle Quality of Life Conference. We have Chiara Ramella and Ed Stocker. Chiara, I'll come to you first of all. It's like it's never been away. We did, of course, have a hiatus last year, no conference in 2020, and both Andrew and Tyler have been gathered around these mics to reflect on what it means to be back. But tell us now that the session's all wrapped up, it's been good, hasn't it? Bringing the old qual back and meeting people face to face.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, it's been a joy to see returning people, you know, people that we hadn't seen in a year or more at this point, people who have come to plenty of conferences before. And I think that this Athens conference was a bit different from some of the earlier ones that we've done, because it does feel like we're coming here at a very special time. And so I think that the local story really feels like we're telling it at the right moment, and that it can inform and influence other places around the world as well. So I think that in all the Greek panels that we have heard today, we haven't just learned about the situation on the ground here in Greece, but we've really kind of created an example of how a nation, a city can turn itself around, and it's truly a lesson that we can kind of take elsewhere. And then lots of panels that have really kind of touched on some of the most important, I think, contemporary issues that we have right now. I mean, we've just finished with a really moving panel on Beirut and how to rebuild. And yes, it's a story about Beirut, but it's a story about, you know, the much used word resilience and what that means for everyone right now.
And Ed, it's been a bit of a recurring motif today, this sense of Athens' time being now. But what you got a sense of almost palpably today throughout the panels, whatever their theme, was a real sense of reinvigoration. Not just, as Chiara says, here in Athens, but from our speakers from all around the world. Everyone was just excited to be back together, the sense of the world opening up, to be meeting people, doing deals, making new contacts. Something very profoundly optimistic it felt like was happening today.
I know, it feels good, doesn't it, to be doing this again, for everyone to be together, and just to be in a room where there are people from all over the planet, from South Africa to the United Arab Emirates, via Portugal and beyond. I could continue. And so just to have everyone feeding in their own perspectives, asking questions and learning from our panel that's been pretty diverse. And yeah, an interesting time to be in Athens, speaking to business owners, some of whom may have started their businesses abroad and are coming back to Athens and choosing to sort of invest in the future of this city or other cities in Greece, and sort of hearing their stories about how it's all developing here and changing was kind of fascinating. And I haven't had a drink yet, but I will be having one shortly. I just wanted to add that.
Well, it ended in a very tantalising way with our good friend Chandra Kurt, who Monocle 24 listeners will be familiar with, whetting our appetites with some wine selections. And I know you guys are itching to go and join the revelry, which, be assured, Andrew, will go on long into the evening. But let's just touch upon maybe some other panels. Chiara, you mentioned a few already. Another highlight, perhaps, because we've challenged the, you know, cultural norms. We've been all around the world, different geographies. Anything else that really jumped out at you? Lots of upbeat panels today, about that?
Definitely, though I think that I really enjoyed your discussion with neurosurgeon Philipp Schucht, discussing how to keep, I guess, your brain vital.
Into... I don't know why they picked me up to ask the questions. Do I need more work?
Because you need a little... It's also known as. But I think that both Rob and I were commenting on that because it ended on a funny note saying, you know, if you want your brain to stay healthier for longer, you really ought to have a better diet. Don't just eat red meats. Don't eat lots of cheese and don't smoke lots of cigarettes.
And I think you can eat cheese.
Added that to the list of my naughty pleasures and just the thought that everything that I liked was essentially forbidden by Dr. Philipp Schucht. He talked about how, you know, if you don't exercise your brain, it's like a muscle and it will waste away. And so if you rely too much on Google Maps, then you will lose your ability to kind of orient yourself naturally. Rob and I were walking downstairs wearily halfway through the conference thinking like, well, I find this about this now, like, yeah. It's too late.
The crushing reality was that in your 20s or possibly as late as your early 30s, that's you've peaked, Ed.
I want to say one thing. My grandparents sort of exercise that muscle on a daily basis, essentially by bickering. And my grandfather lived to 101, so that's all I'm saying.
Pretty good. I've got a
bicker every day.
99-year-old grandmother. So that wasn't too bad. What about takeaways? A couple of big reveals today. We're going to be going to Paris next year. That was a big one that Tyler threw in right at the end. One quick takeaway, though, Chiara, from today that you'll be... I don't know, what will stay with you as we come back to London and get back to normal?
Well, I think it was really interesting to hear from Thomas Chatterton-Williams because I think that we have just all gotten too used, ourselves included, to listening to opinions that we agree on and I agree with. And I think that, you know, in that panel, there were certain things that I agreed with and certain things that I didn't agree with. I was kind of pleased with that because it's okay to examine lots of different ideas at the same time. And I think that was the main takeaway from that you don't always have to agree with everything that's said and that's stimulating for your brain.
Old contrarian Ed Socker doesn't have any problem with that. What about highlight
for
you,
Ed? Have to say, I actually, that panel's made me think as well. I've kind of it's good, like Chiara said, not to agree with everything, but also just I think perseverance and passion were on display in full effect today, and so I guess those are two things I've taken away, saying all the people in this room and the fact that this came together, just also everyone behind the scenes, including Carlos Ribello but here in front of us, so just all the hard work that everyone's put in at Monocle as well.
Our star producer of the day, Colotti, yeah, big thanks to her and all the team here on the ground. Well, Andrew, from young contrarians, Chiara, Ed Socker and myself, back to, I don't know, the superannuated contrarian in London, Andrew Muller. Andrew, back to you.
Yeah, I heard that, Tom. Thank you for that. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference continues in Athens. We may have more of what we gleaned from it next week on our programmes. Back to Chris and Alexis here in the Daily Panel, on the Daily Panel, in, on, next to, whatever.
Besides.
We will move on. The caning of a successful film or series with a sequel is established practice. The prequel is a more niche exploitation. The latest to have a pop at the prequel is acclaimed 2000s gangster series The Sopranos, which fleshes out its origin story with the film The Many Saints of Newark, released this week to generally good notices. By way of emphasising its authenticity, the younger Tony Soprano, who was of course played in The Sopranos by the late James Gandolfini, is played in The Many Saints of Newark by his son, Michael Gandolfini. Before we get into this, who here among us wishes to confess at this point to never having actually seen The Sopranos? I will go first. I have never seen The Sopranos. I am that guy at the table.
I am also, as it happens, that guy at the table, I have to say, which is even worse because I am, you know, an Italian-American with family originally from New York and the region. So in that way, perhaps it's just that I already know what this is about.
You didn't have to. You know, it's just
I didn't have to. It's all part of family lore in my family.
You get enough of that at home. Alexis, viewers, listeners, is sitting there with an expression of just absolute thunderstruck bewilderment.
What?
Speak.
Do
speak
you,
if
do
you can.
Do you both live under rocks?
I do.
Oh, we are.
Yes.
We are always aware of these things as they exist. We then simply let it pass us by strange choice.
I'm not doing a contrarian thing when I say I've never seen The Sopranos. I'm not having not seen it on some great point of principle. I don't think people who have seen The Sopranos are bad people. I've just not got around to it. I'm sure it's very good. I suspect I'd probably like it when I saw it.
It's very good. I can give that.
Okay,
drop that bomb right now.
Well, having established that neither Chris nor I are qualified to pronounce upon the necessariness of a Sopranos prequel, are you a Sopranos fan, Alexis, excited to see The Many Saints of Newark?
I'm not excited to see it necessarily. I am of the opinion all great artworks exist they exist within their own greatness and space and, mm-hmm. and you don't mess with a good thing. You know, I've got a theory which is called the Simpsons paradox.
Okay, go ahead. Let's have it.
Which is that every season too far you go past the great golden age, mm-hmm. or when a series should be completed. And I talk about TV series because, you know, I think you will both admit that even though you haven't watched The Sopranos, the kind of the box set, the TV series, is the kind of preeminent fictional art form of our time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Okay.
And if we're using those kind of that rubric, then The Sopranos is the closest thing we have in that form to the great American novel, I would argue.
Okay.
The Simpsons was it's good. Its golden age was so good that, you know, but they didn't know when to stop. They didn't know when to say enough is enough. And actually, that's the thing, you know, David Chase, who the showrunner of The Sopranos, a genius, you know, he knew, I think, it's six seasons long, which I think is the perfect. And each episode is an hour long. So again, you know, it's a commitment to watch. So I think it's like, I can't remember, it's many hours long. It's like a few weeks or something.
So if nobody herewith is convinced of the necessariness of a prequel to The Sopranos, is there anything that we would like to see a prequel of? I was going to be glib and say Airplane, but the more I actually think of it, the more I do actually want to see the prequel of Airplane, where we go in a bit more to Ted Stryker's backstory and the catastrophe over Macho Grande, which obviously he will never get over. Sorry, that thought is now going to haunt me of...
That is an extra excellent choice, Andrew, that I had not thought of before this show, and I would have picked otherwise. I would love to see a war movie come out of Airplane, because that is one of my favorite movies, and they went three forwards, but they should go back one.
Yeah.
I want to see a prequel of the Bible.
I think you could go ahead and write it. I mean, you could make up literally anything. Like, yeah, what goes on in your prequel of the Bible? Do we just have God and an infinite nothingness? Wow, has today's show taken a turn? Before one day he decides, you know what? I'm just going to create the universe and everything in it. I've got a free week.
Yeah, I think he goes to a party, gets a cold, and then he sneezes, and then he looks down. Uh-oh, what have I done?
Well, on that metaphysical note, we should turn actually almost appropriately to a report from Monocle's Latin America correspondent Lucinda Elliott, who has been musing on how different countries in her region treat their older folk.
Is aging just for the old? This question was put to hundreds of filmmakers from across Latin America and beyond, part of a new festival that takes place in Uruguay. The first of its kind anywhere on the continent, the Cinema Festival of Aging, or FIS, wants to show other ways of representing the elderly by reshaping stereotypes and celebrating the fact we're living longer and better lives.
El primer festival internacional de cine sobre envejecimiento es una propuesta universitaria de cooperación.
From September 22nd, the final selection of 66 films, a nod to the state age of retirement in many countries, will compete for the standout prize. Screenings alongside workshops, both online and in person, are taking place between Montevideo and the northern city of Salto. Carolina Guidotti, a trained psychologist from Uruguay's National University, spearheaded the project. She explained how old people so often are seen as others or a problem for society, and not as an extension of themselves and people who really contribute to our communities.
The themes discussed are very varied. They go from the passing of time and historical memory to questions linked to family relationships and older relatives, to sexuality during that time of life and human rights, to how different generations relate to one another. There's a multitude of themes.
Entries that range in style from documentary to animation will be judged by a panel of academics, as well as movie critics and industry producers. There are works from Cuba and Brazil, Italy and Panama.
Olá, meu nome é Luiz Alberto Cassol, sou diretor do curta-metragem Grito. O Grito tem como tema...
One thing many of the films share, Carolina noticed, is that they don't simply focus on the successes of those who are older, presenting the grandpas who still jog, the great aunts who retire gracefully, or those who look good on camera. Instead, the work recognizes diversity in aging, the challenges that come with it, and a strong emphasis on social inequality throughout, one of the big challenges for societies globally. Uruguay is an exception in South America, where countries generally have sizable young populations. In the last census, more than 14% of Uruguayan adults were over 65, rising to nearly 20% of those over 70. The island of Cuba is a close second. No surprises then that Uruguay is well ahead when it comes to analysing its older population. Studies began in the late 1970s, but it wasn't until the year 2002, when the International Assembly of Aging was hosted in Spain, that more detailed research was applied and funds made available. The pandemic, Carolina said, has been a moment when we've all been made incredibly aware of the elderly, but perhaps not in the way we should.
¿A qué me refiero con esto? A que, de alguna forma, durante la emergencia sanitaria,
during the health emergency, problems that were already circulating in society really became visible. Concepts the public have around older people and aging became clearer, with stereotypes and prejudices that were already there, cementing further. Notions, for example, that the elderly are only a group at risk, and so we must care for them, must shield them, but not actually asking them how they want to live. We're only looking at how fragile older people are, when in reality they make up such a diverse group, who have an awful lot to give.
The organisers are surprised at how much interest there's been around the festival, with over 500 entries this year and plans for the next one, possibly linking other Latin American cities, already in the works.
We want to generate a change in these perceptions, plant a little seed of change with the festival to build other ways of seeing the aging process.
For Monocle, feeling 5 years younger in Montevideo, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thank you, Lucinda. Alexis, you have recently been in Athens, which is a clearly recurring theme of today's show. You had some thoughts about how the elderly are treated or how they treat themselves, really, in Athens.
Well, I think as we've seen with recent furore over the social care tax or crisis in this country, there's I feel it. And we were just talking now about this, the fact that in the UK, and I think in the US as well, that older people are kind of ghettoized a bit. You know, they live alone or in homes, and there's not so much intergenerational mixing. Whereas in Greece, I observed, you know, lots of older people live with their grandchildren and children, and... And I don't know, I specifically in one town I visited called Leonidio, which is in the Peloponnese, beautiful place, nestled in the mountains. And every evening, all the bars and cafes were full of older people catching up with one another, you know, drinking coffee. And I don't know, it just seemed like a much more, you know, I think when you get to a certain age, and at any age, obviously, social interaction is incredibly important. But I think especially as you get older, it kind of, you know, it's very important to talk to people and meet up with people. And I feel like that's something that's maybe lacking a bit in the UK.
Chris, is this something that societies in general are going to have to get better at as people lead longer and, well, by and large, actually healthier lives? It does strike me occasionally that we are still wedded to this extremely post-World War II idea that basically by the time you turn 60, you're pretty much done for.
Well, I think what we're going to have to get used to in part is, yes, this more of a collective sense of everyone helping, you know, helping each other from young to old, as it were. And I think it's as Alexis was talking about there, that is something that has gone lost a little bit in our societies. Personally, I was reminded from that when visiting Beijing and how it, in Asia, it is also something that is more common, also seeing more elderly out in parks and gathering. There is more of a society, a collective gathering there than I think we see in our own societies as well. But it is something that is nice. It's a positive when you see it. And I like this idea of a festival for the aged as well. It was very nice.
Chris Chermak and Alexis Self, thank you both for joining us. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Today's show was produced by Alexis Self and Charlie Filmer-Court, research by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.